Hello, everyone. Before we get started today, I want to make a quick announcement. We are going to do something that is unprecedented in the 6.5 years of the Highlands Bunker podcast. I think it's well due, though. We're taking a week off in August. We've done 2 patrons-only pieces over the last few weeks. We have about 90 minutes of conversation, really good conversation with the crew this week. And I think it's time for us to take a quick breather. In 360-odd episodes, we've never missed a week. And let's be honest, we could do one next week, but we're not going to, because we're going to take time for ourselves to rejuvenate and refresh. What I'm doing, personally, is going to the U.S. Open 9 ball in Atlantic City so I can watch some professional pool. You guys do whatever you want. Go to the beach, go to the mountains. You know, don't think about anything political or organizing-wise. Take a note from the Network Delaware playbook. They take the whole month of August off, which is like a very European sort of nice thing to do. And so I feel like we should at least take a week off in August to, you know, give Carl a breather. Guys out there, he's churning. Anyway, I really enjoyed this episode. There's a lot of cool stuff in it. We did a crew episode with a couple of different segments. I think you will enjoy it. So until next time, left is best. I got a call tonight from Jennifer Chatton, Josh's mom. All I want to say about that situation is we're on it. Things are happening. And, you know, we take this kind of stuff very seriously. But she also gave me some information that I want to read to you. It's a little promotion. Black August, honoring those who fought for liberation. Black August is a time to remember our political prisoners, honor our ancestors, and recommit to the fight for black liberation. This year, we're coming together with the Black People's Coalition, Black Mothers in Power, I know them, Black Men Build, and Prison Riot Radio to focus on prison reform and the urgent need to end mass incarceration. Join us for this month's political education night, where we reflect, build, and learn how you can get involved in the fight to transform the prison system. So this is Monday, August 18th, 5:30 p.m., 5:30 in the evening. The location is LJ's Playpen, 2601 Carter Street in Wilmington, Delaware. We will have this linked after this. There's a free dinner for anybody who registers at the link. There'll be speakers, there'll be education, but most importantly, they will tell you the best way for you to get involved to help us make sure we stop torturing men and women who we put in prison and reform what the hell it is we're doing, because it's fucking crazy. From the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. This is Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Hello. I feel pretty good, I have to say. It's always nice just to have a nice sort of mellow crew episode. So joining us is Bill Martin. Thank you, Bill, for coming.
Sure. Good evening, Rob. I feel like I'm sitting in one of the airplane exit rows tonight.
That leg room. What's up? See, we can do this studio right now is very versatile.
Fully customizable.
We call it versatile. It's another V word that we like. There's another one that we like. We can't say that, though. You know? Carl, thank you for coming.
I always fit in here no matter what. I'm like 5'7", like 70 pounds right now. So
yeah. You know what? We're going to have an intervention at some point about this.
Like my son Everett, we're going to have to start putting a lot of butter in your food. Actually, yeah, that probably would be worse. I don't know.
Or would depending on what you're putting in.
That's true.
Yeah, yeah. We care about you, Carl. We've been talking about this over and over again. So I want to start off with a little bit of a story. I'm going to be a little indulgent tonight, but I think you guys will appreciate it. And also there's a point to the story, if I can.
Sure.
So I was out today in the afternoon, went to the pub to watch Spurs and PSG play in this Super Cup. So the two tournament winners. Of course, Spurs fucking blew it at the end. That's typical. But there's a French guy that comes to the pub who throws darts. He's a great dude. This guy, Terry, we talked to him. He, you know, he's a PSG guy. I'm a Spurs guy. So it was a big event. Everybody was out. So in between pool games, I come to the bar to get a pint. And our friend and comrade James Johnson is there. And on the other television, the Phillies were on, but it was a rain delay.
Or I remember this.
It just happened.
Yeah, it was. They're playing the Reds this week.
It just happened. And he noticed that they were doing a little documentary about the old Phillies player that is I think it's narrated by Ryan Howard.
Yeah, Dick Allen.
Dick Allen, right.
Ryan Howard. Yeah. Watch that. It was short, but it was interesting.
So here's the thing. What I never tell you guys because I make fun of your baseball fandom. Mm. I'm a huge baseball nut from before. I just don't follow it anymore. My dad was like a baby boomer guy who was way into it. I was way into it. I'll give you an example. Just one. My dad, for his 14th birthday, in the late summer of 1964, got taken by my pop-pop, his dad, to Connie Mack Stadium to see a doubleheader. Phillies and the Dodgers played at Connie Mack. The Phillies pitchers were Wilmington's own Chris Short and Hall of Famer Robin Roberts, facing off against Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax.
Wow.
So, like, I know, like, I got the history all built in. I know all that stuff. And so my dad actually saw Dick Allen hit a home run at Connie Mack Stadium. Connie Mack used to have a weird ground rule, like the Houston Stadium had, where it had the hill and the flagpole. Connie Mack was so far out, it had, like, a little fence there with a flagpole, and that's where they put, like, the batting practice shit. It was just way out there. Similar to like the old Polo Grounds, if you're familiar, like where Willie Mays made the catch.
Right, right.
It's just like, a rectangle.
It just opens up out there. It's like 500 feet, but the ball just rolls under the clubhouses. There's nothing out there. It's just nothing. So anyway, there was something out there, but my dad saw Dick Allen hit a home run to center field into that thing. That was the only one he'd ever seen. Maybe that ever happened.
Wow.
So anyway, we're talking about Dick Allen. And James goes, you know, Dick Allen has, like, this incredible war ratio. And I'm like, well, what the fuck is that? And he goes, it's wins above replacement. Mm-hmm. It's like this money ball thing. And I couldn't remember whether you guys were teaching me that or some other.
No, it was OPS.
Some OPS other plus.
So anyway, there's all these new stats, right?
Wins above replacement.
Yes.
Like, so the, Carl, correct me if I'm wrong. The replacement player is a zero. They contribute zero wins over the course of 162 games. Right. Mediocre. Yeah.
Yeah. And generally, it's like if you have a zero war player, they're not actually really replacement level when you get down to it. But yeah, it's an estimation.
Yes. But anyway, there's these new statistics that we can measure. And, you know, for reasons that are even my dad told me this like in 1980s. He was like, yeah, they're racist. He had a horrible time. He was Dick Allen was he was his own sort of like a Reggie Jackson figure. He had his own personality and his own thing, but he was such a great player. But he never got sort of the accolades he would have if it wasn't for like social stuff and just like the way that went. But he had this now they go back and they use the modeling tools of today on players and statistics from before when they didn't keep these stats. They couldn't because of computers. And now they can say, actually, this guy's value for that team at that time was way, way, way higher than, like, you know, the guy that's reading the Inquirer box score kind of thought it was,
right,
or the guy going to the game thought it was. So there's these tools that actually capture the value of something that the people, the experts at the time, had no idea what it was. As a matter of fact, they would tell you that the players that you think, and let's take this is like the fucking plot of Moneyball, the players that you think are bad are actually very valuable, and we can win with those players. Now, I don't know why this story resonated with me this week.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I don't know. Mm. You guys can, you know what? Like we said, you guys can fucking sort it out.
It's also funny to say that with Dick Allen specifically, because if you look at his like back of the baseball card numbers, dude, they're still pretty good. He had a, like, running through his like early Phillies years, he had a 318 average, 302, 317, 307.
He's a 300 hitter.
He's a 300 hitter.
He ended up having 100 RBIs ever?
Like,
he's hitting 100 RBIs, I bet.
Did he have 100 RBIs? Yeah, he had 110, 101, 113.
Yeah, those are only the stats I need.
So he's driving in over 100
runs every year. And he hit 350 home runs, and it was like on pace for like 33 on average a year. Like,
he's a Hall of Fame. That's your Hall of Fame.
That's
numbers.
A Hall of Famer.
Yeah, yeah, if you play 10 years or more at those figures, you got to get in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But again, I think maybe it's social stuff, but definitely, you know, I don't think when you talk about, and again, I don't know if you guys are like old heads, but when you talk about third baseman from that era, you're talking about Brooks Robinson, you're talking about Eddie Matthews, you're talking about, I think the Reds had a great third baseman, I can't think of who it was, but nobody ever says Dick Allen. Well, Dick Allen was better than any of those guys.
Yeah.
But we didn't understand how to measure it. Do you see? The way we value something changes and gets more complicated over time, I guess is what I'm trying to say. I don't know if that's I don't know.
Just an independent thought.
Apropos of nothing. We'll
share one fun name, Carl. Do you remember Bubba Starling?
No.
Okay, he was a Blue Rock probably 7-8 years ago. Okay. First round pick, center fielder, looked great in baseball pants, probably like 6'4". He couldn't hit 200.
Poor guy.
He like maybe stole bases because he was fast as hell.
Look at his...
He was a guy who...
He should be laying down bunts, legging him out.
He was like one of these guys who he probably had like the quarterback scholarship. Well, not scholarship. Quarterback offer for some big SEC school and chose baseball instead. But I don't know. I think he made it to the majors, but...
He
just
did.
A cup of coffee.
Negative 1.8 war.
There you go. See, that checks out.
You know what?
Bubba. Baseball name also. Just Bubba.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's one.
That is a great one. So, two things. One, I wanted to interrogate sort of, when we were sort of talking about it before Bill got here, how this research is going on your sort of Delaware Way book.
Oh, yeah. People are going to come expecting something very different. I'm going to hit them with... DuPont files.
You're gonna give them a big whack in the head.
Yeah. So I can give a little overview of that, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think people, if anybody follows the Delaware Call, they will have seen that I was on a bit of a writing bender for the past 8 months. Really, just since the election, I had a lot of stuff that I'd been writing or had thoughts about, and so I was just writing a whole bunch of stuff because there was the Knights of Labor podcast, there was the Wilmington Federation Teacher Series, and there was a few different op-eds. I haven't published anything now in a couple months, but don't worry, that's not because I'm not writing, but I'd wanted to do a series of some sort on the history of the Delaware Way, because I'd been thinking about, you know, it's very clear, I think, that things are changing right now in Delaware, and I've had a vague sense of that for a while, and I thought it was pretty obvious that it's like, oh, I don't think it's because I'm particularly special or because this candidate is so good or this or that. Like, I don't think you can explain the amount of disruption that's been happening based just on the fact that, like, oh, these people are really good at organizing. I think there's something deeper going on. And so I was like, I want to get a better sense both of, like, how the Delaware Way came to be in the way that we think about it of, like, bipartisanship and compromise and... corporate over everything else, and you know all the different things that we think of with Delaware Way. So like, where did that come from, and then where, like, why is it not as powerful as it used to be? And so I had written a little bit after the election about just sort of like the state of Delaware politics. It was like the life after Biden thing that sort of tried to give an assessment of where we are right now. But I do think it was also not ahistorical, but it was not really focused on the history necessarily. But when I was researching the Wilmington Federation of Teachers piece, I was able to dig a lot more into Wilmington in the 1960s and just how radical things were. And I saw a lot of stuff. There is like Wilmington Youth Emergency Action Council. There was people like Chezzy Miller who served a term. There were the People's Settlement was like organizing rent strikes. You had all these things that were happening in Wilmington, not to mention what was going on like the DSU campus with the sit-in at Legislative Hall that I believe got the student body president expelled because of his involvement with that. You had obviously what was going on campus with SES. And then, you know, not to mention you have Russ Peterson from 1968 to 1972 who passes some of the like only progressive reforms that Delaware's ever seen. And so that all got me thinking in the sort of sense of, okay, it hasn't always been like this. So what happened? Where did that go? What happened? And then why did the thing that happened next also not work? So right now the focus, I was going to write 4 pieces in the Delaware Call about this, but then it was getting way too long. And I was talking with our friend Dale Norwood. He's like, yeah, just write a book. I was like, okay, why not? Let's have some fun with it.
Yeah.
Got plenty of time.
I don't have anything else going on. So that is now the attempt of the project. Basically, the area I'm covering is from like 1950-ish through the present day. And I guess just to give my hypothesis, and I need to do the research to make sure this is true, but I've read a good amount of like secondary sources already and like been doing a lot of newspaper research, which is basically, in the 1950s and early 1960s, you had a lot of structural things that were changing. You had desegregation, you had the building of I-95, you had the reapportionment of Delaware State Legislature, you had a general rise in like middle-class progressivism that represents like a Russ Peterson-type politics, but then also like a black radicalism that represents what like WEAC and sort of the stuff that was going on in the 1968 riots that they don't talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this then coincided with sort of a crisis in the 70s, which obviously nationally we know about stagflation, we know about gas prices, but Delaware was basically bankrupt for these years. And we had actually the highest income tax rates in the nation. We had all this stuff that seems kind of crazy to talk about now. And for better or for worse, Pete DuPont steps in 1976 and it's not just him, but that administration really transformed the way that politics worked in Delaware. And him and Tom Carper was honestly a pretty big part of this.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I was wondering what your the focus on like the...
Because Pete DuPont and Tom Carper came in at the same in the same year.
Because in the Carper piece, you talk about how, you know, they sort of use that financialization as a tool to sort of pull us out of whatever like a muck we were in.
Yeah.
And Carper is a big part
of that. And so you got late 70s, 80s, early 90s, basically this ossifying of a new Delaware way. And then I think the important thing, and I think that is all, parts of that are all covered in some things already. Like the narrative of like Pete DuPont comes and saves the day is very well established. If you like actually go back and look through the literature,
that was the message at the time. He's the savior.
And I found a great like op-ed from 2000 in the News Journal that was like, the Delaware way is so great, because this is really when they started using the term publicly. It was around 2000.
Celia Cohen, I think, was...
It might have been Celia Cohen.
I don't want to say the inventor of it, but I believe she made it popular.
Yeah. Cause that's,
yeah, I don't think she's the inventor of anything, but she definitely... No. She definitely, when they started using it, she wrote it down.
Yeah, and they specifically mentioned, like, because when I heard about the Delaware way, my assumption, like, just 2017 or so, I was just getting involved in politics. My assumption, because I never interrogated it, was like, oh, it's just how things have always been done. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of how people want to portray it. But the op-ed is very clear that, like, no, this started in 1976. This is the year that we started doing this.
Your boy REV is older than the Delaware Way.
Yeah.
Just remember that.
But the piece that I wanted to add to it, because I think people put different start dates on it. I sort of started, honestly, in the 90s, which is there's been a lot of structural things that have happened in Delaware over the last 25 years that have eroded the base of the Delaware Way, both politically, economically, and socially. And the reason that you're seeing stuff like WP candidates winning in primaries, like kind of out of the blue, the reason you see someone like Matt Meyer able to appeal by running explicitly against the Delaware Way, a lot of that is not because, WP is so amazing or because Matt Meyer is so smart, but rather because they're tapping in, like they, we, whatever you want to say, are tapping into something that has been going on under the surface for a long time. And so I'm really interested to see how deep that goes when I actually dig into it a little bit more. But a lot of it comes from dishonestly, the things that I'm looking into come from my conversations at the doors. They come from working with candidates who come from specific backgrounds or stuff like that. And just like looking into the background of neighborhoods and institutions and stuff like that and see where these things come from and why they now seem to be leaning towards us in a way that they didn't before. So it comes from personal experience, but I'm trying to like do the research to see if that actually backs it up.
Yeah, my question is, because I'm a little bit older, I sort of lived a little bit of this. What did James Murphy say? I was there.
Right.
I was there at the first Can show in Cologne. I always thought that, yes, what you're describing definitely happened. They definitely sort of like created a narrative around what they did. Delaware Way being like the narrative around this sort of financialization and, you know, corporatization of the state. I always liked, and I don't know whether any of your research so far bears this out or you have a feeling on it one way or the other, but they were able to do it because of the little tiny size, like principalities in Europe that are like little tax havens, they're always small, like sort of easy to manage. It's like a little, like it's a duchy, or it's like a, you know, it's always like Costa Rica or an island or, you know, Luxembourg or something like that. And I always found the fact that it's this little tiny tidewater principality on the ocean makes it like rife for this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a part, like I was posting about this yesterday on Blue Sky.
That's where we post now. Actually, I don't post there.
Yeah. I mean, it's healthy.
It's for the academics.
But it's all like Dale and his friends, basically.
I'm more of a clown type. Yeah.
But, Chance loves it there, too.
Chance, Dale, yeah.
It's for smart people.
We love.
We do love them. That's true.
That the thing about like Celia Cohn's writing that I'd really noticed was, and she's, I think, the best example of it. She's not the only example of it, but a lot of folks like her write as if everybody's in on it.
Yeah.
And both in the sense of like everybody's in on sort of the narrative that you're telling, but also just like you could tell she was in a room with like Tom Carper and Frank Biondi and John Daniello and like all the guys. And they like had a narrative around how things went, and she's almost like a part of that narrative, right, in that sense as the political reporter. But then even the way I've noticed it in the Only in Delaware book is the way she talks about voters is very interesting. And some of it's fair, some of it's unfair in terms of like how, but she talks about like, oh, voters didn't like this, or voters thought that was crazy, or like, and it's like, is that like the entire electorate? Is it just the people who vote in this election? Like, what are we talking about when we talk about voters? Or is it just like,
well, they'll never. The thing is,
it implies a very intimate conversation that I don't think was necessarily happening.
Yeah, it's this canned response. I hear it all the time too, to this day. Well, they'll never go for that.
Yeah,
right. They'll think that's crazy. It's like, do people talk? I mean, actually, to take it out of Delaware for a minute, that's how people talk about Mamdani.
I was gonna say, we're going to New York, right?
Yeah, they're like, hey, they never like that. Actually, they all like it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, I understand what the messaging is like, we can't do anything, quote unquote, probably like radical, because they'll never go for it. But who is that? Like, who won't go for it exactly?
And, you know, part of the thing that I'm doing more research on is, like, you can look at electoral patterns, and I think it's probably safe to say that, especially once you get to the 80s and 90s, there is a very substantial block of voters that are socially liberal, fiscally conservative, bank employees, like people who work in the corporate world, people who have a vested interest in financial conservatism of some sort.
The people who I'm in that MBNA alumni Facebook group.
Exactly. Yeah.
Buddy, I have a lot of intel about that. I don't know what to do with it because people know that I worked for MBNA for a little while. And I'm just, doesn't make me feel good.
Yeah.
So no. I just try to ignore it. But I do have a lot of intel about that. We should talk
Excellent.
About that.
All right. Offline.
But yeah, so that's sort of like, I think you can make the argument that voters, quote unquote, were this or that. But I think people, one, I think that's a little overstated. And two, I think people especially overstate it now because it ain't the 90s anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That and again, it's hard. That's the part that's actually hard for me to get perspective on. Because, you know, I graduated from the University of Delaware the third Saturday in May in 1996. And by the first Monday in June, I was employed at MBNA. So, like, there was an aspect to this that definitely could hook people in. Now, what I learned extremely quickly is that this job program that they did, whatever you want to call it, bringing the banks here and hiring dipshits out of fraternities at the University of Delaware, actually was like working in a factory in the Industrial Revolution.
Mm.
But like you don't really, you know, you get sort of sucked into it. And I understand why there's an MBNA alumni thing because, you know, they people like Celia Cohen and Carper can redefine the American dream. And they're like, actually, if you're in a cubicle and you can answer 175 calls a day, then you can live the American dream. Mm. Also, we're going to ask you to work on Saturdays. And also, really, the payment is getting to 200 calls a day. And then maybe you'll make an extra dollar. You know, it's just like, okay, I see what's happening here. It's a production shop. It's just a production shop. But yeah, I can see how there was a small audience for this.
Yeah.
You know, and so, like, that's the only people she's talking to when you're like, oh, these people will revolt.
Yeah. And I mean, even if you look at the voters, like, the turnout wasn't particularly high. And it usually really tended to be a certain group of people. And not to mention just like primaries were not real. I mean, first of all, primaries didn't really exist until the 1970s. But, you know, the idea of people regularly getting primary didn't really happen until 2016-ish. So maybe it'd be interesting if, like, more primaries had happened earlier, if more people would have gotten thrown out earlier, but...
Yeah, there's something about the contest or, like, making sure there isn't a contest.
Yeah.
Like, our message is the message. Like, what we're doing is the thing we're doing. And, you know, there really wasn't a... There wasn't a way to say, actually, we don't want to do this. There actually wasn't a method. There weren't primaries, for example, like you said. That's a sort of a newish phenomenon.
Yeah. And, like, you could. And, you know, if you look at, like, Jack Markell and John Carney, that was probably the first example of an upset in any real sense in a primary. Because you go back further, you might find specific examples of, like, you know, Dave McBride and Bobby Byrd or whatever. Like, you can find examples of people getting primary, but it's not
that
it's
classic not the same thing. That old classic.
The Markell primary was, I guess, maybe it's like pretty similar to Meyer winning, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's probably the 24. Best example.
I think it's a fairly similar.
Because it's, one, there's no incumbent. Two, right. It's sort of they're both established elected officials, but one is sort of seen as like the next in line and one isn't.
Right.
Wow, Meyer, the new Markell. Matt, you might maybe you'll live with the family in a villa, in a Roman villa.
in
Villa Taverna.
Embedded in Villa Taverna.
Yeah, it's a Roman villa. Apparently, it's very nice.
So, Carl, what other observations are you getting from only in Delaware? I'm remembering. I think I read it when I was like 23 or 24 And it was the first summer in a few years I was back home, was working at the courthouse. I think I actually shook Russ Peterson's hand that summer. So I guess this was my, you know, I was still on the Howard Dean campaign fumes.
Okay.
And
that comes up quite a bit.
It really does. I think it's a thread throughout the Highlands Bunker. But I remember it wasn't a surprise, but it also was kind of surprising to have this picture painted of, especially north, like Brandywine 100 area, northern Delaware, being this sort of like League of Women Votery, like
the Republican,
do-gooders. Yes. I don't know. Are you seeing any other
sort of, you go back to 80s baseball and everybody's talking about hot dogging? Do-gooder is like the politics version of that. It was like, why is everybody talking about fucking do-gooders? Like, I mean, the book is interesting. I mean, one, it's very thorough. Like, I'll give her that. I think I've probably said this on the podcast before, but the opening chapter is about a dinner party or something in the 90s. And it's a bunch of like Democrats and Republicans, but it's specifically people who are involved in the, secretary who got killed.
Emery Fahey.
It was like a bunch of different people on different sides of the Emery Fahey situation. I was like,
Is there different sides?
Like people who are related to the murderers and like people who are prosecuting them and like
people
all
who did
stuff.
Them.
Yeah.
People who are related to the people who did them.
And then it sort of closes that out being like, only in Delaware. I'm like, that's not a good thing. This isn't like a positive story. She was murdered.
Like you have to,
just like a weird way.
Like you
frame
have
it.
To deal with the Capanos.
Yeah.
Even today.
Yeah,
even
they're
though,
still around.
Well, I mean, the DuPonts are worse.
Yeah.
Yes. Killed I mean, people. Are they inbred murderers? Maybe. Sure seems like they're at least murderers.
At least one is a murderer.
Well, and the DuPont.
Yeah.
Actually, more than one DuPont is a murderer, just to be clear.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at actual body count, they win by a mile.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, charged murderers.
Correct. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, look, only in Delaware. We have to
only in Delaware.
We have to be like, hey. Yeah, it's going to be a very, very interesting and, dare I say, popular book.
Yeah. And I think, at least the way that I'm writing it right now, I don't think it's going to be as like axe grindy as people would expect, given the position that I'm coming at it from, but.
Well, that's what's going to make it good. Plus, based on your production of Storm the Fort, which again, I was working this morning on my iPad in the kitchen, drinking coffee out of my Storm the Fort mug, which I think I just stole from you. You left it.
I keep being like, I need to get you and Bill and Medina and Kirsten all like.
I already
mugs.
Have one. You left yours here.
That one's
so
not
I
very
it.
Good.
I have
a better design for a mug on my thing.
But will you? Will we get an audio version as a visually impaired citizen? Will I get an audio version of this book?
Probably.
Read by some of our faves, I think. That would be cool if you had like each
we could do
chapter
that, yeah.
read by somebody.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I don't know what the timeline
is on
this,
it would be
but...
good. Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, just do it before I'm dead.
Yeah.
I kind of came in today. I knew we were going to have a kind of a light the crew episode and, you know, keep it clean of reassessment chatter. I tried working on a list. This is something Rob and I were brainstorming last weekend, like getting some picks, you know, like a Limelight Delaware Highlands Bunker edition picks of the week. So no reassessment 2025 chatter, but I've got a special edition, my inaugural Bill's Picks.
I love it.
All right.
Because we're hanging on this because really what's important is that for people in the media, people connected, to tell you what their picks are.
Yeah.
That goes without saying. Okay. So.
All right. So Bill's Picks, non-2025 reassessment edition. And all these pieces, you know, this is we are a pro-journalism podcast. These are all the News Journal, and that includes the morning news,
the evening news,
every evening.
And the evening news,
the DuPont news.
So, unless otherwise attributed, these are all TNJ. All right. Reassessments draw few protests. February 21, 1985. by Rolf Ryken. This is a quote from the story I just found, pertinent. "I don't want to know what the market value is," the 59-year-old retired electrician said. "I don't want to sell my house. What are these people? Real estate men?" All right, number two.
Rolf, that's a good question. That wasn't Rolf, though.
Rolf,
he wrote
no.
this. That was the electrician who said
Get how you spell Rolf's last name. This is so metal, in my opinion. R-Y-K-K-E-N.
Double K.
It's like Dokken.
That's crazy.
But Ryken.
There's an umlaut in there.
All right. Reassessment's flaw. Short time to appeal. May 4th, 1986. And that's another Ryken piece. Kent tax rate set too high. Reassessment firm blamed. August 5th, 1987. That was by Rhonda Graham. Reassessment? Politicians dread the prospect. We're jumping in time a little bit. That's April 10th, 1995, by Robert Moore, who was a real reassessment head back in the day. Tax reassessment bill finds few supporters. May 31, 1997. It's by Nancy Kessler and Robert Moore. State may take over property assessment. March 27th, 1999, a piece by Nancy Sharon and Robert Moore. And here's a kind of a neat quote or a summary from the piece. State Finance Secretary John Carney says that the Carper administration would support full state funding of reassessments in all three counties, expected to cost as much as $15 million, as long as the counties agreed to update them regularly. The counties are legally responsible for reassessment.
We got our ass on that one.
Yeah.
What year was that?
99.
These are some quality picks.
The names don't change. We just get older. School leaders seek reassessment. That was February 6, 2002 by Molly Murray. Reassess to shore up schools. That was February 27, 2002. It was technically a Delaware Voice column by the columnist Jim Purcell. New Sussex surplus begs for property tax reassessment efforts. That was February 8, 2004, by the editorial board. States, counties looking to reassess have wide range of options. July 1, 2007, by Mike Chalmers. There's an interesting detail in this story for the real journalism heads. In 2004, the town of Seaford's officials attempted an inexpensive reassessment and were promptly sued. The city contracted with an inexperienced Dover man and agreed to give him half of whatever additional revenue his work generated in the first year.
Dover man.
Inexperienced,
you know,
Dover man.
Here's the thing.
That's what they're calling you down at city council, Rob.
This episode is now going to be called Dover man, I think.
Okay, he only raised the assessments on a third of the properties, ignored those that should have gotten a lower assessment, and told city leaders that most property owners would simply pay the new bill without question.
Can't believe they hired him to do it this time, too.
That guy is the founder of... I'm not going to say it, sorry. I was going to say something.
That was only 20 years ago.
21?
They were still just hiring experienced Dobermen off the street to do this stuff.
He was like, nobody's going to look at this. Oh, my God.
Okay, jumping ahead just a couple more years, bringing it more into more recent times. Reassessment on the back burner. February 4th, 2009, by Angie Bazadunny. County Executive Coons hopes that the issue will return to the top of the state's legislative list when the economy is more stable. So that's the picks this week. If I were doing this as like a newsletter, I would include this image as sort of like some clip art, you know, engagement bait to get people involved. This was a 1985 letter to the editor that I just wanted to share. It's titled, Taking Shirt Off Our Backs. Several recent letters have expressed concern and surprise that following the 1984 reassessment program, our Newcastle County property taxes were increased. I said in a 1983 letter that the reassessment would result in a tax increase. I also said that the tax revenues from construction projects such as Strawbridge and Clothier, Chanel, and the Folk Road office complexes, ring the bell, should have helped to make a tax increase unnecessary. Our elected officials are well aware of the public's apathy and forgetfulness, so weep not if they take the shirt off your back. They have a bureau of some kind to keep it in. Lloyd E. Champion.
Lloyd E. Champion. Actually, I changed my mind. The title of this episode should be Lloyd E. Champion.
Bill's picks.
That's the best. You know what? They rival anybody's picks. That was actually very good.
Thanks. No discussion of 2025 reassessment, a topic that's off limits.
No. All we talked about tonight are brand new computer baseball stuff and old newspaper stuff. Really? Yeah. I mean, that's it. I don't even know what else to say.
Well, Carl, maybe tell me what did I see yesterday? So, like, I was down in Dover. I was in
I was blissfully on break until this morning.
Well, let me tell you what, I was there because Tyler Technologies, they said that I have two full bathrooms. I have one and a half. So, I went down to Legislative Hall yesterday to get some answers.
Did you drive in your Fisker automobile?
I did.
Thank God.
Still running on the same battery.
Never recharged. Thing's infinite battery. We actually lithium
and Bloom Energy.
Yeah, Bloom Energy. We have slaves in Peru getting the fucking lithium. We just put it right back in.
Well, slaves in Peru. We had legislators in the legislature yesterday.
We did,
and it was a long afternoon and evening. But I don't know. Can you tell me what did I see yesterday?
From what I can tell, having not watched any of it, because I was trying to respect my vacation, it seems that people are very upset, and perhaps more upset than they've ever been in their whole lives. So there were some bills that were passed. I know we had talked about with WFP. There was Medina Wilson Anton worked on a few bills.
Who?
I think Ray Moore had a bill or two.
Ray definitely had a resolution.
Yeah, that's what it was. And it was very clear from the start that none of these things were going to get run. So we did this.
Was that because they didn't ask?
Because if they just asked really nicely, I think they would have run it. Or if they involved all the stakeholders.
Is there a list of all the stakeholders?
Yeah.
Is there like a check?
The only leadership gets to have the list of all stakeholders.
I see. Okay.
And they will not tell you who they are.
Oh.
Sort of like stakeholder Calvin Ball is sort of the basic idea in terms of who's on the list, who's not. And so there was a lot of discussion about what bills were being run and what bills were not being run. That was really the main gist of it. And then I know Medina introduced a lot of amendments that were basically like, well, if you're not going to run our bills, then like, there's still a lot of good ideas here, so I'm going to bring them up anyways. And some of them passed, which was great. So that was good. But there's a lot of drama now. I mean, I think I said this publicly, that I don't post on Facebook anymore. Every Facebook comment, I put it in a document, and then sometimes it adds up, and I write a piece in the Delaware Call, and that's what happens. But otherwise, I don't do that anymore.
Is that kind of like your form of like pausing and like not hitting send?
I wrote a whole thing this morning.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm gonna send this in a text and then I'm not going to send it to anybody. And
yeah,
all I know is the only Facebook stuff I see is the stuff that's so outrageous that you guys clip it and put it into a private group chat. And when I see it, I think, I'm so glad I don't have to fucking deal with any of this.
Yeah, and so needless to say, there's a lot of people who are having a lot of big feelings today about how yesterday went, and I don't know, some stuff got done, other stuff didn't get done.
That's not controversial, bro. You said you were going to start an argument. You're not even starting an argument.
No one's saying anything. Everybody's too chill today for me to start an argument.
I mean, you can. I'll try to start one.
Okay.
After hearing the Bills picks, after hearing how that went, and after considering sort of like where we're at, do you think that this was a productive hill to try to take? like you're going to expose yourself on this hill. You're going to go do, you know, you're going to write bills. You're going to do posts. You're going to do press conferences. You're going to do all that. Considering that the political environment, do you, and considering what the issue is, like, yes, people are mad. They've always been mad. They've been mad for 40 years and more.
Well, yeah, because there's inexperienced Dovermen that are
inexperienced Dovermen. But also there's
better
people.
Than Tyler.
But also there's the there's Branch Rickey from you know or Charlie Comiskey,
right?
Who didn't put black people on there because they didn't know what the fucking a war or the all these things were. Like it's just not a to me. It wasn't a winner. It wasn't a winning, because of all these aspects to it, it wasn't a winning political fight. Like, I would have retrenched and probably just dug in my artillery and just chilled out. And considering how it went, I think I was right. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, I've seen a lot of people saying a lot of really nice things about what Medina did. So
that's fair. You're right. You're right about that.
And it's, you know, I think it was, let me put it like this. This is kind of what I wanted to argue about.
Yeah, perfect. I love this. Thank you.
There was something that was said, and I think it was a misquote, to be fair, to her. But Representative Mara Gorman, who I've been very clear that I'm a big fan of Representative Gorman, said something that was along the lines of, like, a lot of people have been asking questions of leadership, and I don't think we should do that. And I think what she meant by that, because it was phrased in a specific way, and I think it was more meant of, like, you're unfairly criticizing because they're black women, was, I think, the implication of that.
Right.
And not like, it's not that we can't criticize or ask questions of leadership, but like a lot of people are doing so in a way that isn't fair.
Jumping in from the editing bay real quick, just to give full context on this, because I had not seen this post when I was talking yesterday. Representative Gorman put up a post on her Facebook that said, "During debate on whether we should suspend the rules, I spoke in support of trusting the leadership team we elected at the start of this General Assembly to help steer us through this quickly. In the moment, I said we should stop questioning our leaders. Some have taken that to mean I think we should blindly follow without asking questions. That is not what I meant. What I meant was that we've chosen a leadership team, we've entrusted them to make certain decisions so we can act together in urgent situations. This doesn't mean they can't be questioned, it means we recognize their role to help us move forward quickly when needed. I could have expressed myself more clearly, and I ask with humility for your grace and understanding."
And then the Republicans had a response to that, and Medina had a response to that. And that is sort of like, as far as I can tell, that's the thing that people are getting very upset about on Facebook. A lot of people have been posting, and, you know, I want to, you know, take Mara at her word that, like, what she meant was not, like, you cannot criticize leadership. But that type of rhetoric, I think, is very interesting, because I think it sort of, it's stuff that, in the context of the Democratic caucus, is very unremarkable. But when you say it out loud in front of a room of people that's being live streamed to the entire state, people are like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said about being more strategic about when we criticize people and don't criticize people and how to do this and that. But also when it comes to, like, for example, a press conference, because you're thing with the press conference is like, why are we even doing this? Isn't a winning issue, yada yada. Other people's issue with the press conference was that it was like grandstanding, or it was like going around doing this the wrong way. And my argument is, like, it's politics.
Correct. Yeah. I'm glad you drew that distinction, because, and maybe I just want to say this and then you can pick back up. The idea of questioning leadership, I don't care about that. Do have a press conference, say whatever you want to say. Whatever Mara Gorman said, I think, is probably either clumsy or stupid. And I saw Mimi's long post alert, because you guys put it in the chat. And just to be clear, this isn't because you're you're black. We're not questioning your credentials. You're a tool of the establishment, and you're a fucking tool. That's nothing to do with your race.
And since this
it has nothing to do with that.
Since this has happened now several times, I would like to state for the record, the things that I say are my opinions.
Correct.
The things that Rob says are his opinions.
Correct.
Just because something is said and I don't immediately go, you are wrong, does not mean that I agree with every single thing that he says.
So most you of do these I'm working on. You do think it was racist. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
But so, you know, I think that's a point that should be made, because if people think just because I don't speak out and say, well, like,
I mean, I thought, and Bill is the third party here, I think it was pretty clear we're having a sort of an argument here.
Isn't yeah. And I think it's.
So we're obviously, we're on two sides of the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If people can't figure that out, they can't figure out why we talked about Bill's picks or the war, the war statistics.
Make it very clear for folks, because I don't think
everybody gets it. It's a comedy journalism podcast.
Look, hey, everybody. Wake up. Wake up, everybody. Wake up. If you can't fucking figure it out, I don't know what to do. You can't help us, really.
Yeah, and for the record, I do think that in many ways, Mimi has been treated unfairly because she is a black woman.
By whom?
A lot of different people.
That lady from Coast TV.
God damn it.
I just don't think that then removes her from criticism on a lot of stuff that she's doing wrong.
Okay. Yeah, and I can only speak for my very pointed, crude, very funny criticisms. Like, you're a tool of the establishment. You're, you know, back slapping and having nights out with the ladies and, you know, all of this stuff. And that's my critique. To be perfectly honest, my critique of Mimi Minor Brown is the same critique I had of Pete Schwarzkopf. That's it. I couldn't be more fucking clear than that. It's the same critique I have of Kim Williams, of anybody who's just a centrist lay-down dog who's just going to do whatever the corporate and police people say to do. And if you think that's because you're a woman or because you're black, it's not, because I hate Pete Schwarzkopf more than any of you. Ed Asinski, not really happy with you either. So I don't know how much more clear I have to be, just to speak for myself. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so there's a lot of drama around that, and I just think I've had this conversation, because I'm not saying that WFP legislators are perfect on this front, but people really need to stop posting on Facebook.
Well, that's goes without saying.
Like, there's a lot of cases with folks that are elected officials, and they will get into arguments with just like random people, or not random people, I'll be fair, but like,
can't believe you said that about Andrew.
Facebook addicted shut-ins.
But like, you know, even people that are like activists or something. Oh, so not random, but like, maybe they know each other somewhat. But
yeah,
I think everybody just has to keep in mind, like, you're an elected official. You need to hold yourself to a higher standard than that. Like, we can sit in here and shit, and like, I hold myself to a higher standard than like other activists, because I am like a staff member for an organization that works with a lot of elected officials. So like, I'm very intentional about choosing my words and when I say things and when I don't. But yeah, I think if you're an elected official, you gotta stop arguing with random people on Facebook. Please.
It's very juvenile, like, but, very but, immature.
But here's the thing. That's the whole thing. This is the conversation we have. It's like, why do you say these words? Well, all of them, you know, I can read a long Facebook post about the doctorate degrees you have and the books you wrote and the this and you did this and you did that, but you're acting like a teenager in an 80s comedy with your gossip and your fucking nonsense. And so sometimes when I interact with you on the same terms, you don't get it. But you don't have to act that way, as Carl is saying. Just act like a fucking adult. You don't have to do that. Like, you don't have to have your husband responding to random people and being like, I don't think so. Like, that doesn't, you don't have to do, stop doing that. I sort of said this a week or two ago about people that are more attuned to our politics about the reassessment. You don't have to do this dumb shit. We don't do it. Like, do you think I'm embarrassed of anything we've ever done in here? Absolutely not. Because people are scared to come here. Because they know we know what we're fucking talking about. And we're not doing dumb shit on Facebook. We're not on Facebook. That's the real sea change we need, is what Carl said. Stop fucking doing dumb shit. Get to fucking work. You know.
Posting isn't work.
Sorry. No, get to work. You know, fuck, use your media presence as a way to get your message out. Not to argue with fucking anonymous random people on fucking Facebook. It makes you look dumb. And if apparently Mimi doesn't like to be called stupid. That's a big problem. And I have to tell you, I'm not saying this because of your background or race or family or anything other than you're doing stupid fucking shit. So fucking stop it.
And then I'll be fair and speak to some folks on my side, which is, we don't need to antagonize people anymore. I'll do it a little bit in like a strategic electoral sense sometimes, you know, I'll admit to that much, but well, I'll leave it there.
I think what you said is very important. I think what's been pretty obvious, not just to me, but to like, seems like casual commenters, that this issue, whatever you think about it, became the sort of like the crucible where everything's going to be hit. Like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, all of these different petty little teenage disputes are now, you know, people's feathers are ruffled because they have to come in August and they're getting all of this different shit. And it's not the usual grind. It's something different. And so everybody wants to now use this moment to adjudicate all of their petty fucking political battles, which, again, I'm not surprised they're doing it. I'm just pointing out that it's not productive. That's it.
It was theater. I will give them that.
Yeah. I think kind of to maybe cap this off and wrap it back to my earlier information or the earlier like research that I'm doing. There's a big thing, and I forget how much they say the word specifically, but it's everything's just oozing with it, which is the Pete DuPont, like, catch-all word is, like, responsibility, which is we have to be responsible. Because actually, when Pete DuPont got in there, and he eventually cut taxes, like, a crazy amount, but when I was looking through some of his correspondence, he had a couple, like, crazy right-wingers that wrote to him and were like, we need to abolish all taxes and repeal the Coastal Zone Act. And it's a very interesting letter because he says something along the lines of like, well, I think you would agree with me that like taxes and environmental controls are necessary, but it's just a matter of how we do them. And like our budget is really tight right now, so I cannot cut taxes as much as I would want to because we have to be responsible.
Okay.
And I was like,
ready to go, Pete.
Okay.
Pierre, ready to go, Pierre.
Yeah, Pierre.
Pierre's fucking doing it.
I forget who was telling me this, that because he had the like nickname Pete Sixpack because he was trying to seem more proletarian when he's on the... God. And people were calling him Pierre Six Pack, but PACQUE.
you're deep in the research.
Right? Yeah, but I think there's something to be taken from that, which is I do think that I've said this in other cases, and I'm fine to say it publicly. I think, which is, I do think that elected officials have a sense. Or need to have a sense of responsibility and selflessness that I don't see in Dover a lot. Because I think like a lot of the stuff that I've seen on Facebook is like people talking about how they personally were offended or how they personally took this and that and like how they've been wronged and they've been aggrieved. And like, once again, I'm not saying that our folks are perfect on this. And I think this is a general thing, but like I talk to them one-on-one because we have a trust like that. I don't know Mimi like that, so I'm not gonna like call her up and be like, "Hey, you did this." If you'd like to call me, I can. She'll get my number.
Mimi,
I think we actually we
Mimi, come on the podcast. It's a beautiful. We have a beautiful studio.
It's here. Delaware, you know. It's
we have. We can make you a nice drink. We'd have a nice time, actually.
But I think there is this, this mode that people operate in, and it's gotten worse, I think, in recent years, of just like a very individualistic sense of how politics should work, specifically in the legislature. And I think that's wrong. I think, like, not to, you know, be too on my high horse, but I think we should hold our elected officials to higher standards. Our elected officials need to hold themselves to higher standards. And if you feel offended, if you feel wronged, if you feel like people are being mean to you, I feel for you. And you should have a personal support network of people that you can vent to and talk to, but you should not be posting that shit on Facebook.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's totally, like, everybody, Melissa Minor Brown, Medina Wilson Anton, Matt Meyer, fucking President Trump, like, everybody's human. Everybody is going to be treated unfairly. I've been dealing with this a lot myself, too, because once you get into politics, that's just what happens. I'm not even an elected official. And people are going to be mean to you. People are going to lie about you. People are going to say this, and people are going to say that. But ultimately, I do think, especially for elected officials, but then I think also for, like, people who have power in other ways, you need to be able to, like, one, learn to just kind of roll with the fucking punches, and two, how to take it and keep going. Because we do have a responsibility, and that responsibility is not to acquiesce or to, like, just do the things that everybody's saying, but we have a real responsibility to make sure that the people who are actually being affected by the shit that we're trying to do are able to live and able to thrive and able to do all this stuff. And that requires being a bit bold sometimes. That requires doing things that the lobbyists are not going to like. And it requires, like, you probably doing some more work that you don't really want to have to do. But that's what it is. That is what happens when you decide to get into public service. If you want to be in public service, but you complain about having to be a public servant, then you're not in the right place. So that's my thought on it.
That's it. On the topic of sort of dealing with criticism, dealing with public critique in a healthy way, I'd like to tell a story about how NoCap Delaware has dealt with critique and insult publicly in a healthy way. Can I do that?
Please.
Last week on Thursday, there was a public safety and police reform town hall in Dover at the library, sponsored by Tide Shift Justice, the ACLU, NoCap Delaware, and the League of Women Voters. It was held on the second anniversary of the signing of the bullshit bills 205 and 206 that were fake police reform. If you read Val Gould's work in The Call, you'll understand the significance of this anniversary. The cool thing about this is it was covered by WBOC Baltimore. So we can link to the story. One of the great activists and community organizers in Dover, Shell Paul, was interviewed. I was interviewed. Miriam Dede was interviewed. So it's a great piece. When the piece went out on WBOC, of course, the reporter asked the police department for a statement on this. Now, I did mention that there was many, many co-sponsors of this event, but part of the police statement said this.
The Dover Police Department supports open dialogue, but we firmly believe the reforms brought by House Bills 205 and 206 have been meaningful. We have entered into a new era of accountability and transparency that balances the interests of the public and the hardworking public safety professionals that serve them. Dover police officers continue to serve this community with integrity, skill, compassion, and a commitment to doing the right thing all day, every day. Broad generalizations about policing undermine an appropriate examination of the facts here in Delaware and the great progress we have already made. NoCap has come to Delaware with the intention of disparaging the police department to achieve political goals. They have brought a biased and unprofessional initiative that can only have one outcome. Should a member of our community have a complaint about policing, there is a legitimate process that enjoys widespread support from both the community and the policing profession. Our focus remains on providing superior service to the community, building trust, bringing solutions to difficult problems, and continuing to support our officers and support staff as they put their safety on the line to create a better Dover. Those looking to exploit that effort are not serious about public safety and disrespect the people that do the work.
So on Monday of this week, I discussed this at the Dover City Council, and this is what I said. I really have only one objection to that whole statement, and that is that NOCAP has been unprofessional. We have not been unprofessional. I don't think anybody can point to any incident or behavior of anybody speaking for NOCAP that's ever been unprofessional ever. So that's nonsense. That was the first point I made. The second point I made is the political aims. They mentioned that we have political aims, but they don't mention what they are. And I didn't think that they knew what they were. So I had to, you know, cop to it. I said, you got us. We do. We have a political agenda. And our political agenda, is what I told them, was that we were going to organize and mobilize the community in Dover to apply pressure to change laws and regulations and rules so that the people have a say in how they are policed. So I called that democracy, but you call it whatever you want. I said that the city council would also have a say, but they wouldn't have the only say, which is kind of what they sort of want. So I just wanted to be real transparent about our political agenda, because that's what it is. Third point I made was really quick. They say that this effort can really have only one conclusion. What did it say?
It was like one resolution. There's only one outcome.
Only one outcome. I don't know what that is. And I said that I'm prepared and open to any kind of more public discussion about what that one outcome is, because I don't know. I'd like to know. And with that, I closed my comment to the city council. Thank you, Tanya Whittle, for being the Bill Martin part and reading it at the council, and also driving me, because I can't drive. Also, left is best. Thank you.